The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. For the month of October, we're going to be having a look at films about hauntings. Now, this means that most of our conversations are going to revolve around issues of physical and psychological trauma, abuse, and other forms of violence. If this material just isn't for you, that's totally fine. Feel free to skip this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Just wash it all,
wash it all away, it will haunt you. Ladies and gentlemen, and creepy well children of all genders, welcome to the Movie Morgue, the Movie Autopsy Podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery.
And I'm your co-host, Annie Neller.
And today we are digging into the 2002 adaptation, The Ring, directed by Gore Verbinski.
Gore Verbinski? Is that who really directed it?
Yes, Gore Verbinski directed this. I am not actually familiar with his work. Except, okay, no, Rango, Pirates of the Caribbean. Okay, no, I dig his thing. Okay, so. Let's talk about context for this film, because we're doing our series on hauntings, and 2002, this was kind of a significant film in the horror canon, especially in the Western canon, because I think it is, for many people, and for me at least, it was kind of my introduction to Asian horror. There was a slew of adaptations, I think, in the wake of the success of this film, most notably The Grudge, and of them, like, I think this is the only one that really mastered the restraint. So it kind of holds a special place in my heart. I had this on DVD. I've watched this a bunch of times.
Oh, wow,
I do
really?
Not remember if I saw this in theaters. I don't think that I did. But this is a movie that's very dear to my heart and that I haven't watched for a few years. So what about you, Annie? Do you have any history with this film?
I didn't know that you had a real affinity for it. I had never seen this movie before. I've heard lots of things about The Ring, and I remember hearing things in the early 2000s. I wasn't familiar with this movie going into it super a lot. But I
so
was
you have
familiar...
never seen The Ring?
No, I've never seen The Ring before. I have seen movies about Japanese ghost stories before, like Kaidan. The 1964 movie was something that I had seen that contains a similar story with a woman in white Onryo character, but not quite this. So this was a really interesting watch for me. This was something new.
Cool. This is what's kind of interesting to me, because I just assumed that you had seen it.
Mm-mm.
Because this movie was huge. It is, you know, as we were discussing this a little bit earlier, it is the number one remake horror gross. It technically doesn't count because the original film adaptation of it was a TV miniseries, technically. So those are different formats and are accounted differently. So yeah, this is kind of wild. I think we just want to get into the review portion then. Okay, actually, one more thing. Quick bit of context. The Ring is a adaptation of a 1991 novel by Koji Suzuki, Ring.
Mm-hmm.
And also of the film adaptation, the 1998 Ring, directed by Hideo Nakata. So, just to double check the prestige, because we actually found there's a bit of an interesting kind of production history around that, because the Suzuki novel was adapted like 3 times before this movie came out. There's a Korean version, there's a 1995 TV video movie adaptation, and then there is Ringu, which is the famous one. But concurrently with this, there is also a sequel, which is a spin-off series that also has very similar things. Like, the girl in this film is Samara, but she's widely considered a adaptation or romanization of Sadako, who is also the name of the villain in that. So, like, it's kind of wild, and we don't actually have a full grasp on it, but this was, I guess it's fair to say it was a hot property.
Very hot, apparently. If it's being made this much in different forms of visual culture,
over a 10-year period like this.
Yeah, that's very...
And it's very different, I think, also from how we see, especially like novel adaptations, in America and the West, because typically optioning is a big revenue, it's a big potential revenue stream. And typically, even if you don't make a movie, you option for exclusivity. So to see all these different movies is not something that I think is really analogous to our experience of, you know, like Stephen King books, for example. So, that being said, let's get to reviewing this. And Annie, I was not expecting you to have not seen this, so I'm really excited to see what you have to say about The Ring.
Okay. You know, I think I'm going to give this one an A-. It's definitely an A-range grade for me, because I think this film is very well put together. It's very well paced. The way that they do horror in this movie is so in tune with time and practices of looking and seeing things you shouldn't. I really like that. I think that the story behind it is really kind of fascinating. I just have a lot of things about this movie that I really like. The one thing that does irk me a tiny bit is some of the dialogue feels a little patchy in places. But other than that, for the most part, I think this is a pretty solid horror film. To me, at least. I don't know. What's your take on it? Since you've seen this multiple times.
You know, I think I'm going to average this out to an A. I think I'm going to put this one as an A+, because honestly, I do not have, like, trying to call to mind immediately, I don't have any really criticism of this. And the thing, I think part of this is also, I am grading this among its peers. I'm, you know, this is, what, 16 years later? But I, for the reference, I have not seen any of the Japanese Rings, and I think we definitely want to cover those at a later date. But
oh yeah,
we are looking this, first of all, as a haunting film, and secondly, as within a part of kind of the Western canon of horror films. And among similar ones, and especially among haunting movies, it's very much head and shoulders above a lot of its competition and above a lot of what it inspired. Because one thing that still intrigues me to this day, and I think it's kind of ruined by the fact that there is a sequel and, like, that we've talked about it so much, is what this film did so well is it understands horror. Because one of the huge and absolutely huge problems with Western horror is, first of all, franchising, and second of all, is over-explanation and exposition.
Oh,
because
yes.
What we fear is the unknown. And that's a reason why we have trouble trying to remake an Alien movie, for example, because we already know that their blood is acid and that they hide in the vents. It's very difficult to be scared of something when you understand it, because when you understand it, especially as an audience who isn't, you know, in visceral immediate terror the way a character would be, and doesn't have the excuse of, oh, the adrenaline stopped me from thinking, unless, you know, you're really into it, you just go, oh, well, why didn't they just bring a machine gun, you know?
Yeah.
So, in a way, this movie doesn't give you enough information to make a rational decision, and what information does do, these characters behave in, you know, sensible ways and still lose, is it is an evil that is incomprehensible, and that is something that I think a lot of producers shy away from.
Yeah, like the only thing that I could think of that was really comparable to this in my recent viewing was It Follows.
This is,
and even then,
yeah,
It Follows still gives you a tiny bit more of the rules than even this does.
I mean,
but it's
It
still
Follows is very much built in the image of this film. It is yeah, a rule set for a deadly game of which you have no choice whether or not to enter. And once it happens, you pass it on and you are still powerless. You don't win, you survive.
And literally in its image, too, right? Even the style of filmmaking with the jump cuts is definitely very much a part of It Follows. So, yeah, I can see this film as being extremely influential in the horror genre.
I mean, not only that, but it started a gold rush of it started an absolute gold rush of remakes of Asian horror films. The Grudge, Dark Water, Pulse, One Missed Call, The Eye, Shudder, The Uninvited. The absolute gold rush of those. And of them, I think a lot of them got producer notes just saying, this is too confusing. We need to make sure that the audience understands exactly how the ghost works. And the twist. And by the way, everyone, spoiler warning for a 16-year-old movie. We're talking about The Ring. I'm hoping people have seen this one. But it does what I dare say is a Shyamalan-esque twist. And it does it so well because it absolutely punches you in the gut.
I think it out Shyamalan's Shyamalan to a certain extent.
And that to be fair, I think Shyamalan has been flanderized a little bit. Because when you go back to, like, you know, Sixth Sense era, that was still a hell of a twist.
It was huge.
That's our ring. Let's get into mechanics. I mean, we're already halfway there because I'm really good with keeping a tight format. So what...
No comment.
Annie, so what stands out about you for this film? Like, what's drawing you in? Let's just freeform this one.
I think it's partly the exploration of, like, a mom trying to connect with her child. And not really fully knowing how to do that. Like, she's a single parent. She's got this job. And also creating this very strong connection to this malevolent, but also childlike evil.
This is interesting because the child in evil is something that's very classical in horror. You know, Damien the Omen, Rosemary's Baby.
The unnatural child trope, yeah.
But what I find kind of interesting here is, generally speaking, the unnatural child is an oppressor, is an attacker, is an assailant, right? Is kind of a, like, malevolent force. But what this does that I think is such a clever twist is it paints the malevolent child as a victim.
Yeah.
And certainly she is in her own way. But that does not absolve her of the things she does, because
exactly
that is the twist, is you weren't supposed to help her. She never sleeps. It's so good. It's brilliant. I love it. And I think that is kind of what sticks out in my mind about this one, why I love it so much, is it twists on the formula, and everything that the characters want to be true is what the audience wants to be true. You want them to get away. Because this is an interesting thing. Is this, I think, if you had a Richter scale for memes, or, you know, memes, back in the days before, or, you know, demotivational posters, and before Facebook and all the fucking meme culture and meme economy bullshit, this was a meme. This is, and it was on a really huge cultural scale. Like, Annie, you hadn't seen the film, but we were discussing how many times, you know, you've heard 7 days.
Yep.
You know? This was on a level with, you know, do you like scary movies? And that's part of, I think, a real brilliance of this film, is it's very grounded. So much of the imagery and the things that are evoked and made to be terrifying are were everyday things. They made VHS tapes scary. They made phone calls scary. You know?
They made the act of looking scary. Like, that shot toward the end where Naomi Watts is looking at the body and her face distorts in horror is itself horrifying, because we don't know what she's seeing, and then we get this really whip fast flash of his body, like we did with the teenage character at the beginning. And Katie. It's just Katie, yeah. And it's just friggin' terrifying. And it's not because of the makeup or, you know, whatever. It's because of that word that you used before, the restraint that's shown here. The choice of when to show the audience details. That's what makes this film horrifying.
I will say this, though. The makeup is very good, though, because this is Rick Baker's work. I did not know that he worked on this. And having recently been falling down the Adam Savage tested hole, I've got a lot of respect for effects companies and people who work on that. And Rick Baker does great fucking work. And I honestly shouldn't be surprised. I just wasn't expecting it, really.
Yeah, and I think that the makeup fuses that well with the text of the film that I can say, like, no, it's the timing. That is in itself speaking to the level of detail and, I don't know, I guess attention to detail is really what I mean.
Yeah, there is. Because one thing I noticed when you see Katie's head kind of, you know, swing with, you know, her body like settling. And, yeah. You know, her face fills the frame for a second. A detail I notice now that I haven't noticed in, you know, over a decade of watching this film is her mouth is full of blood.
Yeah.
There is so much going on. And here's something I liked about this, actually, is there are a lot of layers to the horror of this film. Because, mm-hmm. We, like I said, we talk in the preamble. We like to at least have a vague idea what the other one's going to bring up. But
we try and know where we're going.
One of the things I notice is I have very strong memories of this movie. I love this movie. I watch it, you know, late at night at one of those big, rear projection TVs. So, you know, those aesthetics that play into the film. Just a tiny little bit. But one thing that kind of sticks in my mind a little bit is I remember seeing this and feeling very much the horror of this was personal. It was threat. It is this character who is the protagonist and therefore I empathize with is in danger and will die. I am afeared for them. And nowadays, I am not a parent, but I am find myself resonating very strongly with stories about the themes of parenthood, having, you know, become a, you know, sole financial provider, having dependents who are not children. And this is a movie about the horror, like, I think possibly an even more resonant thread than the original kind of, because, like, this movie wasn't that scary for me this time around. And that's fine. I was more, like, enthused and fascinating than I was, you know, chilling in my seat. But the themes of being scared for those who are dependent on you, being a caretaker incapable of giving safety to your children, that is such a powerful theme in this movie.
I think, too, for me, it's about the trauma that gets passed down from generation to generation. That was the real horror for me. Like, the jump scares definitely got me because they're well-timed and, like, the whole movie is very, very fluid in the way that the timing works. But also, you know, as somebody who does educational work and who talks about, you know, trauma and histories of trauma and how that gets passed down, there's this real feeling of there's something that's happening in front of me that these people are doing kind of unknowingly that I can't stop and that I know is going to continue a literal ring of trauma, a cyclical thing that cannot be escaped. And that was where I found a lot of horror.
So let's talk about the performances in this, because there's a lot of strong performances in this, I feel. I think Naomi Watts, obviously, is our central perspective character, and she carries this very well. She's very fraught and a little strung out in a way that I think is really suitable. But in particular, what I really like, and this is weird to say because this was in 2002 when this came out, but I like kind of the arc she goes through, because when she first pops onto the scene, you know, she's showing up to Aiden's teacher's office and Aiden's classroom. And she exudes what I want to call this millennial mom, like, bravado, where she's just, like, jumping ahead of the conversation and saying, oh, no, he's just dealing with death. Like you said, like, we agree because I'm also smart and you don't have hold over me. And she's like, you know, this was a week ago. What? And what her character arc kind of is this breakdown of an aura of confidence and surety. And just having that facade completely stripped away. Not, you know, lost, but stripped away, torn down forcibly by these supernatural events.
I think for me, one of the standout performers in this is David Dorfman as Aiden. I think he gives a really spectacular performance, and especially for a child actor. I know that we've talked about child acting before, and we've been a little bit hard on them, perhaps. But he gives a really excellent performance in this. It feels, it's not just an unnatural child performance to me. This is a kid who has too much knowledge, who's seen too much, who's too much in his own head to a certain extent as well. And it just, you get this really strong sense of alienation from him and the fact that his cousin has been taken from him. You know, like, that's taken out a major support pillar in his life. His performance just really worked for me, and he has these big, wide brown eyes that I think just kind of exude an eerie light in a lot of the scenes because of the way that they've done the lighting and set some of the set pieces up. So he was a standout to me.
One thing that I kind of like out of his performance is what I think kind of comes out, and this could be me projecting into this absolutely, but one of the vibes I get, particularly in the ending, is not only is he kind of a haunted child, and there are some slight notes of maybe the spectrum, because that's how all haunted childs end up when you look at these things. But there's also, I think, notes of, like, abuse survivor in there, particularly in the ending where it's like a survivor who is realizing that you're not listening to them is, you know, you weren't supposed to help her. And because he's very contained, I think is a way to describe his performance. It's very contained, is there are emotions and there are thoughts and feelings riding around. But he is so self-sufficient. Particularly, you notice that he is a part of his mother's support structure, not the other way around.
Yes.
He lays out her dress and her shoes for the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
She relies on him. And this is something that, you know, a lot of kids do end up doing. I know for a fact that my brother, being the youngest child, was very self-sufficient.
Yeah.
My mother tells the story that, you know, they didn't even have to toilet train him. He just said one day, "I'm not wearing diapers." So that's out in the public sphere. You're welcome, bro. But where was I going with this? I've just embarrassed my brother on national TV.
Yeah,
but there was a point I was going for.
We know that your brother's potty trained, so I mean that's great. Are you talking about the idea of, you know, like the kid who's a little bit too old for his years? Like, we know a lot of kids do this. There's always one in the family who is
laying out
clothes or organizing things, the caretaker, first child, firstborn syndrome type thing.
Yeah. So he, like I said, okay, I was talking about his performance being contained. But now I know what I was talking about. But when you get to the end, when I'm getting this vibe of, like, abuse survivor, is that's when containment fails. Because he's contained, we're functional, we're holding it together, and then, wait, you helped her? You're not supposed to help her.
Yeah.
And, like, it's not as impassioned as I'm making it sound here, but it's breaking. Something is breaking.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a really powerful moment. And I love that third act, because I wish I could see this in theaters, because one of the unfortunate things about watching this at home is knowing the runtime, being able to see it at a clock, or being able to, like, look down at the tracking, unless you have the restraint to, like, literally not touch your mouse and keyboard, because, you know, I watch this on a computer, then, you know, not knowing when the ending is coming would really, I think, enhance the shit out of that third act. Because it feels like it's absolutely ending. It's in an epilogue, and then it goes, no, this is not the epilogue.
That was actually what I thought was going on. Because, again, because I hadn't seen this before, I really didn't know. And I also didn't look up the plot beforehand either. I definitely thought that it was going to end right after, you know, she'd been rescued from the well. And I was vaguely disappointed by that fact. I was like, I just don't, like, there's more to this story than this. Like, no, you're not forgiven. You violated a major interdiction. You looked at something you weren't supposed to.
And how did that ending satisfy you?
It was great. It was really great, but also really horrifying.
Hmm. So actually, I want to call to... And I don't know if this is a thematic or a technical thing. I think it's a little bit of both. But one of the decisions I respect most in filmmaking is that of the Wachowskis to, you know, color everything green in The Matrix.
It's
weird for that to be one of the things. But, like, it's the pervasive... Because one of the reasons I respect that decision is the pervasiveness and how it informs and infuses the production. And you can feel it in every frame of that movie, right? Anything in The Matrix is green. Anything else is more earth-tony or, like, cold blue. But when you get to this movie, the water is everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere. And it's kind of an inversion almost, I think, on very common metaphors for water. Because one thought I had while watching this is there's that shot towards the end when they're in the cabin, they're down in the well, and the floorboards are unnailing themselves to, you know, throw the TV at her.
Yeah.
And one thing I notice is as the nails are coming up, they only come up once the water from the TV leaks out and touches them. But also, that water is not pure. That water is not clear. It is not a purifying force, as it often is in the film, but it carries silt and filth and corruption with it. It is carrying dirt.
Mm.
Water settles. And I love that. And there's so much more. There's rain at certain times and not at other times. The rain in particular, I think, is kind of the presence of this misery as a concentrated evil. But there's also the water that divides, you know, the island from the mainland. There is the churning blood in the water. And I think, though, one of my favorite subtle details is it's often a sign of Samara's presence when there are pools of water around. But my favorite instance of that, I think, is Katie's body is found in the closet. And when her friend opens the door, she's tipped off by the puddle of water in front of that closet. Finds Katie. Katie goes, scream, funeral, cry, go to a mental hospital. But when Sarah is exploring the house, you see this huge patch of floor with extensive water damage. And it's this idea of a stain that is not a stain. It's just wonderfully done. Any particular visual motifs or anything that you were stricken by, Annie?
Throughout this movie, I was thinking a lot about what this film is saying about representation. Like, a lot of times what we're seeing are not just images of images, but images of images of images. As in the scene where, you know, she's tracing that fly that seems to be just below the screen that she's looking at. Turns out, you know, like, it is a part of the image she's looking at. And then in another scene later on, the fly is on top of the screen. I just thought that was friggin' awesome. I like the way that this movie pulls in a lot of cameras and seems to be talking about the act of looking, specifically as an act of violation. So I'm also thinking not just about the tapes itself for the ring, but you know that scene where Samara is in the mental hospital and Naomi Watts' character has a sort of dream about it earlier on? There's a camera present. They're being recorded. And probably without their consent. And there's just something so interesting to me about that, of having the gaze turned on your body, of not knowing what to do with
that. Not only that, but when Naomi Watts is watching that tape at the end of the film, well, not at the end, like towards the end of the film, there is a kind of tension between what you want her to do and what you know, what you want to know. Because you want to understand the mystery. But also, there is a sense of violation and of, you know, unethicalness to what she is doing. And so, in a way, that creates a tension because you know that she is doing something wrong. And particularly with no knowledge of where the father is, Richard Morgan, played by Brian Cox. Wonderful performance. I'll get back to that in a second. But without knowledge, and the way it's framed to kind of show his absence creates the tension of you're expecting him to walk in, and you know that that violation of her privacy, of his records, that infraction is reason for him to be wrathful. So it strikes her action makes him scary. So it's kind of, I guess it's a transgressiveness of the character, not necessarily the film.
Yeah, and I think it's also, like, the idea of Samara being the image that gazes back. Like, historically, that's always been something that terrifies people. Like, it terrifies me. You know, like, you look at those paintings with the eyes that follow you around. Yeah, there's something so ingenious about them, but there is something frightening about it, too, because we often presume that the gaze is unidirectional. It's at a thing. The thing is not gazing back. But that's a fundamentally objectifying gaze. And this movie does, you know, like, kind of points to that and says, like, hey, like, there's an attempt at understanding that's at least made here, despite the fact that Rachel's character violates a lot of interdictions when it comes to looking at things. So to go
into deep cuts for a second, and honestly, this is kind of a bleedy kind
we're
of
already
deep
there.
Cuts and mechanics we're all, kind of episode.
We're always already but, there.
But, I think we've been over this before, but do you remember what movement it was or what particular painting it was where a model stared back directly back at the painter? Because that was a huge deal.
I mean, there's not a particular art movement that does that. There's a lot of paintings that do that are from different eras.
Yes.
But it's usually somebody with wealth and power and status who's allowed to gaze back at the viewer because the viewer is presumed to be of equal status to them.
Yeah. There's a famous one I'm thinking of. I'm not going to bother looking for the particular here. But what I'm thinking here is kind of a theme, though, is generally speaking, when we look at images, when we look at, you know, life that has been captured, so to speak, it is like we are putting it in a box and we install a one-way mirror. And I think part of the horror of this is realizing that you have not installed a mirror, but you have assumed that you have. You have installed a pane of glass. And I think part of the kind of tension comes from realizing that they have been aware the whole time. This is why the image that stares back is disturbing, is because we assume that we are safe, and in some ways, looking upon images like this does feel like a violation of privacy in some way. So when you realize that they are aware of you, that feels very wrong. And there are many specific instances in the tape, particularly when Anna Morgan looks directly at her mirror at herself at the camera, and when Samara retreats in that same mirror on an opposite shot into the darkness. It's a mess. And, like, there's a reason looking at the camera is a powerful choice to make. And I think the only instance where a character in the film looks directly at the camera, and I'm not counting close-up shots of the eyes, because I think that's cheating. But I think the only instance where a character, an actor, looks directly at a camera is when Samara shows us her angry face.
Yeah.
I also want to talk about a couple things in particular, because one of the things that I found kind of fascinating was the island and the people on it. Because I had this thought while watching this, particularly with Richard Morgan and with Dr. Grasnick, is they are, I think, a very far departure from what you'd consider kind of your typical or, you know, your archetypical portrayal of rural Americans. Is they are well-spoken, they're erudite, and they are complex characters. Whereas I think in many movies like this, like, there would be like a lot more stereotyping and hickishness to it.
Well, so the kind of stereotyping that you're actually talking about is associated with rural areas that are agricultural and on the continental U.S. Oftentimes those are in the South or the Midwest. When it comes to islands in movies, what we tend to get a lot more are stories about fishermen or people with, you know, like a distinctive American accent that's rooted to American history from the past. What I think is maybe a little bit different about the way the islanders are portrayed in this movie is we don't really get the whole fisherman accent thing. In fact, the main mention of fishing that we hear in this movie is about, you know, the infrastructure on the island collapsing, which is very, very real for those of you who may know stuff about, you know, the islands and the maritime provinces in Canada or something that I'm very, very familiar with. So the stereotyping is a little bit different for islands than it is for rural areas. They're still presented as remote people, as alienated people from the rest of society, but not in quite some of the same ways that you would see in other horror films that focus on islands.
Okay. Because for me, like, this, and I'm glad you bring that up, because for me, island portrayals is not enough of a category that I'm exposed to that I'm necessarily thinking of it in those terms, because I'm still seeing, one of the main things I'm seeing in this film is a kind of rural-urban divide.
Oh, 100%. It's there. It's definitely there.
But yeah, Brian Cox's Richard Morgan is, frankly, terrifying. And yeah. I love it. It is probably one of the greatest grim portents from a dying man I've seen on film. Mm-hmm. But my son, oh, he'll die as he is wrapping himself in electrical cables to kill himself.
Yeah.
That is a terrifying scene. And especially because they've dropped hints and they've played with our expectations a little bit, that on some level through various parts of the film expecting him to murder Naomi Watts.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely in the language of that scene and the scenes before it. Yeah.
And ultimately, I think, like, he's subject to a similar twist, because we expect, you murdered your daughter. You're the bad man and you feel guilty, so you want to cover up. And it's no. Is in his last moments, he reveals himself to also be a victim.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, I think that is what kills him, not necessarily Samara's whisperings themselves. Because, and like, this is deconstructing some toxic masculinity shit here, but by being a victim, he's admitting his powerlessness, and being the last surviving member, being a surviving patriarch, a widower, and not, I don't know how involved he is with his daughter's death, but it's fucked up. It's all fucked up, and this is him admitting defeat.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's about admitting that he fundamentally failed to perform the role of patriarch as prescribed, you know, societally, I suppose. The idea that you protect your wife, that you protect your child. Not that you have to protect your wife from your child.
Or yourself.
Or yourself. Yeah. So, very much so, I think it's deconstructing the idea of being the male head of a family and what happens when that gets inverted.
And there's also, I think, there are some weird things going on with gender in portrayal of Samara here as well. Because when you look at the archetypical haunted child or demon child, you think of Damien. You think of a little boy.
Yeah.
Rosemary's Baby is genderless because it's a baby. It's, you know, pregnancy. It is not yet a known quantity. But in particular, not only is Richard Morgan yielding to his child, he's yielding to a little girl. I think the other thing that's important here is it is not some overt violence that he is scared of. It is not something. It is because he names his demons is the whispers, the things she'd show you, is it's about words and images. This is not about being physically threatened. And certainly, since he's lived so long, it's very clear that he has not been given the, you know, the sword of Damocles of the 7-day countdown that everyone else has. He's just victimized.
Yeah, in many ways, I could see it almost being a little bit worse for him because he is literally the last surviving person in his family. So he knows now that this reporter has come to him to tell him that his daughter is back. I mean, that must have been just, I could see that being a moment in which a true psychological fracture takes place. Like, that's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Can we talk, by the way, about all the video equipment for just a second?
Yeah, what is that stuff?
Because
it looked old.
It's really cool. Well, here's the thing. There's some interesting stuff happening because this film is in 2002. This is, I don't think digital filmmaking and digital photography was quite as ubiquitous as it is now.
Yeah, that's true.
Not by a long shot. But it had started to appear on the screen. Sorry, on the scene is what I meant to say. On the screen. Well, also
good
on
job.
The screen.
Yeah.
But that digital analog divide, I think, kind of starts around that era. And we get back to, like, even fairly recently with the, you know, the digital TV tuneover. And that's one of the things that I think is kind of resonant about this film for me is a lot of it is just some really old tech. You know, you got these VHS tapes. You see a lot of contrast. You see, like, the industrial, like, monitoring rack that, you know, Naomi Watts is printing stills from. Contrast that with, like, the fucking, like, you know, 80s-ass, like, vertical tape deck VHS player that Richard Morgan has. You know, with the old school style, like old school answering machine style buttons. And a lot of old technology is really tactile. Particularly, like, I know for the longest time, I hated DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't as satisfying, and also, you know, they were fragile, and I had two younger siblings, so, like, my favorite DVD would never get put in its case, and it gets scratched up, whereas, you know, you could fucking chuck a VHS across the room, and it'd still work. But, you know, there's that satisfying feeling of sticking a VHS tape, and there's a check, 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 you know? And you don't get that today. And so, there is, I dare say, a fetish for analog equipment. And this film is aware that there is digital technology. You know, they use a digital camera to check each other's faces, but this is kind of looking into the divide between the two and the kind of blurriness of that transition. And so I think in many ways the video equipment represents the old world. You know, there's stacks, there are organizations, you see contrast, there's, you know, the old newspaper stacks at the archive of the newspaper, there's microfilm, there's so much stuff that is just, like, old and big and clunky, and we find things that are lost in there, because I think it's especially interesting comparing this, seeing this today, because nowadays we archive so much digitally, and so much about this film is about finding a physical artifact and happening upon it, not, you know,
not like stumbling upon it on YouTube. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
it's not something, it's something that can be found, and because it's something that can be found, it's something that can be lost.
Yeah, and you can kind of see this carried in the thematics of the film as well, because, I mean, what do we have here at its core? We have a film about a child who kills adults. So,
well, that's actually not entirely, that's not true. We have a ghost child.
Yeah.
Samara never killed anyone. I'm going to make that point very clear.
Yeah, that's true. But still, we have the imagery of youth that kills to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be perfectly clear because, like, because saying the little girl that kills, in a way, I think, kind of justifies the actions of her parents. In a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I can see what you're saying.
And I just want to make that, I want to make that distinction.
Yeah. I can understand that, definitely.
Because Samara is, in a way, a elemental evil.
Yeah.
And we are, and this is what I actually kind of love about that, is we don't understand why.
Yeah.
Because there are hints all over the place. There's actually a very brief allusion to the original film in that among the papers about Samara, there is a single page of Japanese calligraphy, and there's in brackets the word Anna written in English. That is the only thing. So it's possible she was adopted from Japan. It's possible that I think the records also show, though, that she was a live birth from Anna Morgan. So we don't know what her origin is. We know that she is wrong. We know that there is something wrong with her, and there is something evil either inside her or that is her. But we don't know why, and we're not given a proper explanation. And this is something I'm going to say. I have not seen the original Ring movie or read the original books. I do know that they go into some fucking wild places. For example, the entire world is a simulation and Samara is a computer virus.
Oh, wait, what?
Something like that. I want to watch those movies. I want to read those books. Like, I want to get into that conversation later. But the explanations that get weird and wild, and not knowing them, I think, leaves space for us to play in. And it leaves space for there to be mystery and intrigue. And I don't think that there is any explanation that really satisfies me. Because knowing what makes her like this pathologizes it. And I think part of what's scary about her is you don't know why she's like this. And there's the ambiguity which lets it be, oh, maybe something is speaking through her. Maybe she's possessed. Maybe she was born. Like, maybe she was injected by Japanese witches. I don't know. But it's also just possible that she's just a bad seed.
Yeah.
And because we as an audience don't know, we also, I think, get to the sense that her parents didn't know, that they can't know why they failed. And that's why their despair is powerful.
Which is also kind of an interesting theme if you think about parenting, too, because at the beginning of the film, you know, Rachel doesn't really know her own child. She doesn't really know what's going on with him. She seems to have some trouble communicating with him, and they just seem to be out of sync with one another. And there's something in there about the idea of the child as an unknowable quantity to adults that I can kind of see coming out through this film. It makes sense to me.
Yeah. So, do you want to talk about the elephant in the room?
Yeah, we need to talk about the elephant in the room.
This is our deepest cut.
So deep.
And we always return to this well. Oh, God.
How dare you?
But this movie is about 9/11.
Yeah, it is. It's 100% about 9/11.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, here's the thing. And I didn't realize this until I watched this film, like 2 hours ago. But from the very opening of this film is... No, not the very opening. From, like, the second thing is, this is a movie about not controlling the introduction to your children of the concept of mortality. Is that is a collective moment of trauma for all of America. Is we all remember where we were when it happened. We all remember the images being broadcast. You know, it's a horrifying, horrifying ordeal. And we're still dealing with the fallout of it today. But I think what happened for a lot of people is a lot of parents had to explain to their kids that, you know, the world can be a violent, random, and unfair place. And so it's like America's dogs all collectively got hit by a car in one day. And every single child looked at their parents with Aiden's eyes.
Yeah.
I think that is a part of why it was so resonant.
I think so, too. I was also reading a couple different books because I was trying to understand what I was starting to see in this movie before you and I talked about this. And there was a book by Jeffrey Melnick that I was thinking about. It's called 9/11 Culture. If people haven't read it, it's worth checking out and just taking a look at. In his third chapter, he talks about the idea of snapshots, of accidental photography, of traumatizing images that are flashed on screens, of found footage and stuff like that, and kind of traces a lot of that to this event. Because 9/11 was fundamentally an event that was about images, right? It was terrorism with an audience, and that was part of the way that it was intended. And, you know, the fact that this film comes out in 2002 and it's very much about parents talking to children about how mortality is imminent and life is unknowable, that just kind of seems to make a ton of sense to me. And also about the idea of an image as viral, an image that you can't get out of your head, that is fundamentally traumatic, that continues to live on after people die, like... Yeah, this is talking about 9/11, and it's talking about a lot of the other traumatic things to a certain extent that happened even after this film and 9/11 took place.
And also, like, it's kind of weird seeing these comments today, particularly from Richard Morgan, is you fucking journalists, you spread it around like a sickness.
Yeah.
It's this misery.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a paraphrase, obviously.
Yeah.
But in a way, that is part of it because, you know, we caught it live and then the media stopped everything and just watched and broadcast that anticipation, that watching to us for days. Is just waiting for the other shoe to drop. Is this fear and this anticipation? Because I don't have statistics on this. I don't know, but like, there were cameras on the tower before the second plane.
Yeah.
And like, being made to watch things is like, this is ultimately what this movie kind of is about. Is there is, I think, if I had to ascribe a motive to Samara, I at least to post-mortem Samara, it would be perhaps to be witnessed.
Yes.
To have her grief exist and persist beyond her.
Yeah.
And to achieve a virality. That's why the rules of the game are, you make a copy, you show someone else, you duplicate
it,
you disseminate
it. Yep.
And what is interesting is it's a virality of information, but it's also because the nature of the information itself, it is a virality of trauma.
Yeah.
And the ending, I think, is kind of disturbing in that way, because the ending, the last thing Aiden says is, what about the person we show it to?
Yeah.
And the answer there, I'm going to say that the take that the thesis of this film is, it's okay if we bomb the Middle East, is a stretch. It's an absolute stretch.
Yeah.
But the idea that we unconsciously spread trauma to others as a means to cope with it ourselves, I think is a very real part of the human condition.
Oh, yeah.
And is even a very sad part of the human condition.
And that extends to even before 9/11. Like, there are obviously more other traumatic events in American history beyond 9/11, right? Like, hell, World War I, the Civil War, slavery, all of these things. All of that stuff lasts in layers of trauma. The trauma is cyclical and it builds and it builds, and you can't fully ever get rid of it. Like, once you've seen an image of a lynching, once you've seen an image of Emmett Till's body, you don't forget those images. They stay with you. Just like how you don't forget the image of people jumping out of the towers on 9/11. Yeah, it's not just traumatization that happens, or even, like, death is almost a mercy in this movie, which is kind of weird and disturbing, because to live on is to relive the trauma constantly.
To live on is to be a vector. You see this even before they understand the final rules of the game, as you copy the tape, is they are already unconsciously doing that.
Yeah.
Aiden is drawing the well.
Yeah.
Sarah is
crossing out faces,
turning depictions of other people. She's not crossing out faces. She's turning other people into depictions of Samara.
Right. Yeah.
Is even unconsciously, these people are spreading their trauma. And it's not in a language that anyone else can understand, and that's why the tape is important.
Right.
But to be exposed is to become a vector for further infection.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking wild.
It is wild, and it also makes me think about something that happened a little bit more recently. So, for those of us who teach, a lot of times, you know, like, we have 9/11 Remembrance Day here in the States and everything, and you have to talk with your students about these things, and we have students who didn't witness this as children because they were too young to remember it, and they still recall it. But they recall it in very specific ways that suggest that they have seen images of it afterwards in different places, whether that be through parents or through remembrance events like what we have. So, like, there's a lot of vicarious trauma that exists outside of that as well.
I think the other thing is the title of the book, I recall, I don't have this in front of me, so I can't say specifically, but I believe that Suzuki said that the title, Suzuki or one of the filmmakers from one of the versions of this, but that The Ring does not refer to you know, the well or whatever, because I'm not sure how much of that was in the original book or the original film, but the ring refers to the cyclical nature of time. And I guess in this instance, we can kind of twist that a little bit and say it is the cyclical nature of trauma.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because we share these. And I think there is a half-life. Particularly, like, you and I growing up, we're still kind of, like, in the last waves, I think, of the trauma of World War II. That still being, you know, the biggest war. And you see, you know, you see boomers and so on having defined, you know, their parents as the greatest generation and the horrors of those wars. So, like, this is something that takes generations to even begin to heal.
But also, even the way that you just talked about time, the way that time is marked is through the marking of trauma. Like, even think about the Judeo-Christian calendar before Christ and after Christ. That's marked through a death. The World War II stuff that you're referencing, baby boomers, that is a spectral reference to World War II. Like, the way that we measure time is literally quite through trauma. So it doesn't go away. I think that was what was so interesting for me at the end of the movie, is that it does not go away. There is not a solution to this. It continues.
Yeah. I mean, This is a thought I had when I was a very edgy teenager, is that in a way I was disappointed by the American response to 9/11 because, you know, forever wars and illegal wars and all kinds of shit that we don't want to get into right now. But I was so disappointed that as a culture that we could define ourselves as pre and post 9/11. And ultimately, that's not kind of where I stand. And now is it's a difficult and traumatic event and there's a lot to reckon with. And it is the unfortunate reality of it. But that is the reality of it, is there is a pre and post 9/11. Yeah. There is a pre and post this and that. Is events define us, and they define generations, and they define people, and they break people.
And images do, too. Like, a lot of people, again, will remember those images of 9/11 from our generation. Other people will likely remember images from Ferguson, or, you know, the capturing of Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein. Yeah, the
Jonestown
is a big one. Also, try and remember the JFK assassination without thinking about the Zapruder film. We literally remember things through images. Like, that's how our brains work. So, I don't know. I just really liked that film made me think about these things again. Like, I can kind of appreciate that.
And I think that is a grim enough note for us to end on. Shall we talk to Mr. Verbinski?
Yeah.
So, Annie, as the first-time viewer, I want your words to Mr. Verbinski first.
Okay. Dear Mr. Verbinski, well, this one was quite a trip. I, oddly enough, really enjoyed this movie because of the discussion that it provoked, and I really appreciate the attention to detail and the restraint that you show in this movie. I think that it makes an incredibly taut and horrifying script, and not just a period piece, but something that has a lot of distinctive resonances in American visual culture. So good on you, bud. Good on you.
All right. And for me, For my dear director, dear Gore Verbinski, first of all, badass name. Second of all, how do you go from Mouse Hunt to this? Ladies and gentlemen.
No one knows.
From the director of Mouse Hunt. Second of all, I also love pretty much everything you did. Please keep making movies. Yeah. Maybe dip back into this well again, because this was phenomenal.
This is a deep well to plumb.
Thank you. That's all I have to say. Like, this is a treat of a film. Mm-hmm. And that's all I got. So,
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I've been your host, Silvio Emery. You can follow us on Twitter at Movie Morgue Cast. Follow me on Twitter at DoubleDocMD. I also stream on Twitch at DoubleDocMD. A lot of horror games for the month of October. And Annie, where can people find you and your work?
Well, people can find me at Lights and Music on Twitter, where I post photos of my dog, pictures of my food, and sometimes I retweet academic journal articles that I think are worthwhile for people to check out. So come visit me on Twitter.
Excellent. And our intro music, as always, is Trouble by the wonderful Ipso Factibus. You can find a link to their EP down below. We are supported by listeners, patrons, and friends. What you can do if you want to see more from us is subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, however you want to do it. Either way, thank you for listening. Tell your friends. And if you want to support us financially, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/doubledocmd. But regardless, thank you, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.